Welcome to Ferment Radio, a podcast series on bacterial and social fermentation. Fermentation can incite social actions, spark creativity, and bring surprising new tastes to our lives. My name is Aga Pokrywka, and I invite you to join us in a conversation on living interconnectivities, from macro to micro, from societal to cellular, and from global to personal. Through language, we not only reflect our relationship with the world, but also shape it. For example, what does the conviction that we need to exterminate all superbugs tell us about humans? Could it be that the core of antimicrobial resistance, which happens when bacteria become immune to antibiotics, is mostly our mindset, which wants to get rid of everything that is impure, different, or misunderstood? On the 30th episode of Ferment Radio, together with Iona Walker, a medical anthropologist living and working in Edinburgh, Scotland, we search for different perspectives on this alarming issue and find inspiration in books, art, films, and poetry. We look for cracks, soft spots, and ambiguities to unlearn what we think we know for sure, and exercise a new language that could help reshape our relationship with the world, including microbes. Join us in this exciting conversation.
I am a PhD candidate at the University of Edinburgh in social anthropology, but I consider myself to be a medical anthropologist, and I've been busy writing the first ethnographic vignettes of my fieldwork. So I'm in the final year of my PhD, and my PhD is about antimicrobial resistance, and it was originally called Reimagining AMR Beyond the Military Metaphor. So AMR is the contracted version of antimicrobial resistance, and this was before COVID, when I was very interested in infections and pandemics and microbial catastrophe before there was one. And then my research has really been shaped by the restrictions of COVID and of the microbial. So I've kind of been carried along in at the whim of microbes and pathogens. But I'm really interested in the kinds of relationships that we can learn about through looking at antimicrobial resistance. So what does it mean to be microbially entangled? You know, we have microbiomes on our skin, in our lungs, in our bladders, that are in our guts, that are essential for life and sustaining our well-being and protecting us and nourishing us. But yet we are very vulnerable to microbial threats through infection. And when we can't control those microbes through antibiotics, what does that do for our relationship with the microbial world? And then further, we're in this moment of, you know, the climate change, pandemics, increased zoonotic transmission, where we're really thinking, what is our relationship with the more than human world? What's the human place in the more than human? And what stories do we have for thinking about those? What stories do we tell each other? What narratives do we have? What language? What kinds of framings? And then how does that affect what we do about particular problems? So with antimicrobial resistance, I'm really interested in, or the catalyst for this work was thinking about the military metaphor. So we've kind of heard about, you know, you fight disease, you fight infection, you have the immune system that defends against invaders. We have superbugs, and there's kind of all these anthropomorphized images of humans versus microbes, or microbes versus immune cells. And then we have this dichotomy of self and other, but actually in practice, how does that work? What are the kinds of interactions that we have? And then for public health campaigns, you know, how do we convey urgency? How do we you know, protect against threats? How do we live well with risk and vulnerability? So there's all these kinds of questions that really motivate my work.
You've mentioned several times antimicrobial resistance, and could you explain it in the simplest way ever?
I'm trying to think of a simple way. So you have, on a biological level, it's when substances that are antimicrobial, so damaging to bacteria or fungi, substances that kill them, the bacteria or fungi develop resistance. So they're no longer susceptible to that antimicrobial substance. They can survive it. And that becomes important for humans because humans have developed, through science and medicine, antibiotics and antimicrobial substances. And those help us treat disease, treat infection caused by pathogenic bacteria or fungi. And it helps us clear the infection so that we can go on and be healthy. But with the increasing use of antibiotics and antimicrobials, more and more bacteria and fungi are becoming resistant. So that means that those drugs don't work. And this is really significant because we use antibiotics to treat humans. We use them for when you develop an infection, but also to prevent against infection for surgeries like C-sections or any kind of surgery that opens up the body. We also rely on antibiotics for agriculture, so to intensively rear animals. You need to be able to keep them healthy, not let them get sick. They can be used as growth promoters or just to keep your animals well so that you can raise them and sell them for a profit and feed everybody, but also for plants. So there's kind of the human side, our well-being, biomedicine as we currently know it. There's also immunocompromised people who really rely on these drugs. It kind of underpins modern biomedicine, biomedical practice. Also food systems, food security, allowing farmers to make a profit, allowing people to eat the food that they're accustomed to, keep supply chains going, but also where people don't necessarily have access to good hygiene or sanitation, antibiotics are really necessary for helping people remain well when they're, you know, at increased risk of getting infections like diarrheal infections in children is a really big issue. So the thing that something about AMR that's really interesting is it kind of permeates all these different levels of our world, of our society, in all these different ways. So we have all these different problems, like we have medicine, we have food, climate, the environment, you know, pollute. We can think of maybe antimicrobial resistance as a form of pollution because your body doesn't become resistant, it's the microbes. And they carry the different resistance genes. And if they get into the soil or they get into the water, then you can potentially be harboring in your body resistance genes that might not be a problem until you become unwell. And then you have a resistant infection that's that the frontline drugs aren't able to treat effectively.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. It's so difficult to put it all apart and, you know, tell it step by step. How does it work? So I really appreciate that. But you've mentioned before about the military metaphor, which is used for describing antimicrobial resistance. And I wonder, did you manage to trace down where this metaphor comes from? Why exactly that metaphor became the most popular in order to explain antimicrobial resistance?
So the origins of the military metaphor are really interesting. And I think there's an upcoming film by artist and filmmaker Mariam Ghiani called Dis-Ease. And she traces the military metaphor from its origins to modern day. So we think of the kind of advent of bacteriology and Robert Koch and Louis Pasteur. And this language really kind of proliferated when we started to see microbes, and we were seeing microbes because they were a problem. So we were looking at isolating the different bacteriums that cause disease, the different pathogens. So we were deliberately, so the microbes that were of interest are the ones that were detrimental to humans, either because they cause disease or because they're making wine go off, or they're, you know, curdling milk when you don't want them to. So we were looking at the microbes that were a problem, and then we're saying, okay, we found the source, we found the scourge, and now we need to control it. We want to either kill these pathogens, get rid of them, or have human control over this sphere of the natural world. So we developed, I think Robert Koch called them the silver bullets, and Louis Pasteur talking about you must defeat the enemy on the terrain you master, so in the lab. So kind of rolling out these lab-like conditions to everyday life. So sterilizing, sanitizing, creating a distinction between the, you know, human dwelling place, the kind of in civilizing language, this is where humans stay, it's clean, hygienic, sterile, only humans in here. And then outside is kind of the contaminating, external, harmful other. And you can really see when you start using that kind of language and imaginary, there's a kind of them and us, self, non-self, that quickly, very quickly can turn into xenophobia, right? So if you start saying one group is us and they're clean and hygienic, and then other people trying to get into our nice sanitized space, that's a threat. So you start seeing these kind of racist justifications for being anti-migration, for comparing or reducing immigrant populations to pathogens. And there's actually been, I think, several studies now that show that increased levels of germophobia correlate quite well to increased anti-immigrant or xenophobic sentiments. So this language is kind of, can be quite insidious if that becomes a logic for how you start thinking about the world, thinking about who is us, who is other, who is contaminating, who is kind of pure. And then you have kind of European white colonists going along the lines of empire in the name of, you know, civilizing, and this logic of bringing hygiene and, you know, imposing public health on kind of the uncivilized world, to use their logic, as a justification for colonial practices, even though, you know, colonists were bringing disease and then stealing native medicinal knowledge to then further expand. So we had the Quechua knowledge for how to make an antimalarial quinine from the Angostura bark, and then that then allowed the British to invade African nations being protected from malaria. So there's an interesting kind of dark relationship between military metaphor, military language, and colonial history.
Wow, that's very interesting. And is it also so that this metaphor, like a military metaphor in antimicrobial resistance, is also part of the problem in order to solve this issue? What would be your opinion on that?
I think the military metaphor is very persuasive when it comes to how we've identified a problem. The problem is AMR. It is in our best interest as humans to do things to help limit the damage and find solutions. So AMR is a big problem. We know that we need to do things to solve it in order to prevent deaths, prevent food chains being disrupted, to learn more about what causes it and how to find maybe alternative solutions to treating infections, as well as promoting the development of new antibiotics, new practices to prevent infection. And we know that that will take a massive amount of resources. We know that we need to raise awareness among prescribers, among people that use antibiotics and antimicrobials, so that they can use them in a suitable way. We need to catalyze innovation in terms of diagnostics so we can use the right antibiotic for the right infection. And that takes a massive amount of energy and people and resources. So the military metaphor, what it's good for is kind of galvanizing a sense of urgency. It's good for organizing groups of people who might not ordinarily work together under this kind of single front of humans against antimicrobial resistance. And it brings a lot of resources and money and energy and attention that's really useful. But I think one of the problems, or one of many problems that I've been quite critical of in my work, is that it kind of concentrates power, attention, and resources in very specific ways that I argue might not actually be helpful for achieving the goal of limiting or solving AMR. So the institutions and organizations that are kind of setting the AMR, anti-AMR agendas are often wealthy institutions in the global north, setting agendas for and policies and work that's done elsewhere. So wealthy countries in the global north are not going to be the most vulnerable to the consequences of antimicrobial resistance. But yet there's a kind of maybe top-down approach to policies. We also have a kind of the military metaphor almost has like a moral narrative to it. So, if you're not with us, you're against us. This is, there's a moral imperative to act there. And it can justify collateral damage and in this sense of urgency, well, we need to get things done. We don't have time for debating ethics or doing kind of maybe slower work, hearing from everybody. We need to take direct action now. But in this constant crisis, which we've been having since AMR was first discovered in 1954, we have Mary Barber saying, suggesting that microbes are becoming resistant. There's been this understanding that there is this antibiotic apocalypse, there is this crisis that's constantly looming, but it never comes. And when you're in this constant state of urgency and crisis, there's no kind of maybe long-term plan or slow ongoing research and work that's helping us understand, why are people using antibiotics in a so-called irrational way? Is it about rational versus irrational use? And actually, when you go and look at why people are using antibiotics, it's actually quite reasonable and quite rational why people are using them. So the common example is parents wanting their child to have antibiotics so that they don't have to take time off work and the child can feel better and stop crying. And there's that, those kinds of parents are often blamed. It's usually, mothers are blamed for irrationally using antibiotics when the child could, perfectly well take 2 weeks to recover at home. But then if you think about it, who has 2 weeks to stay at home with a sick child? That's not really how our society is structured. And in the military metaphor as well, you have this one front where actually there's so many different ways that AMR impacts people and so many interconnected problems that really is one, is there really one single front, or is it kind of a push from all different kinds of expertise, all different kinds of people all over the world? And I don't think we're necessarily there in terms of structures that allow us to do that kind of work, in terms of funding, in terms of resources, in terms of the ability that people have to coordinate that kind of multi-discipline, multi-actor work. But I think that we're headed in that direction, hopefully.
What do you think, when you say multi-disciplines and diverse tools, could you name some of those? And since we are talking here about this solutions which are more long-term, right? We can also be quite idealistic here, even if it's something it's a long kind of a shot. Go ahead and tell us more about possible tools, disciplines, or solution which could kind of help to look at the antimicrobial resistance as a long-term action rather than just a battle, which we have to urgently attend.
From a kind of scientific economic perspective, one of the things that we really are pushing for is better diagnostic technology. So helping us understand what microbes are where and how we can treat them effectively. From an economic standpoint, the frameworks that we have to fund the research and development and then production and distribution of antibiotics, they don't fit very well in terms of kind of your market logic. So with antibiotics, the more you use, the less effective they are, and that's not a great business model. So we need long-term understandings of how we value antibiotics and how do we pay for them. So that is a question of value that I think is really important for us to think about and then practically come up with some solutions. And the question of practically how do you implement that is one thing, but then how do we value medicines? How do we value our time in terms of our, one of the solutions is we have, instead of using antibiotics, you stay at home and you rest for 2 weeks and until you get better. But that requires a kind of rethinking of productivity and what are we doing with our lives, which is a bigger question that suddenly becomes more into the realm of philosophy and the arts. What does it mean to be human? What is a life? What do we value? And then more explicitly bringing in the arts, I think, in this kind of urgency of crisis. When you're in crisis, you can't be creative or imaginative. That's something that I think, or maybe you can, but I think it's really difficult. And we're in this moment where we are questioning and reimagining and trying to figure out what is our relationship with the more than human. What does it mean to be living at this moment of kind of this crises of all kinds everywhere? What do we do with that? How do we, how do we think about that? How do we think about ourselves ecologically? That's kind of a new thought, but it's still quite alien, thinking about you having communities of microbes inside of your body, that your cells are outnumbered, up to 10 to 1 by microbial cells. That's quite uncanny. That's quite a different way of thinking about what does it even mean to have a human body. Is a body really fully human? And that's where we can kind of go beyond language by looking to the arts for ways of communicating, understanding, questioning, working through the emotional aspects of these kinds of questions. And then what I really value about artists and writers and creative people is that ability to kind of show us different angles of these problems, to represent and communicate from a different angle, from a different perspective. It's not necessarily linearly going towards, you know, problem to solution in a straight line. It's speculative and more open, and allows us to see both things at once, right? We can hold the fact that we might be disgusted by the microbial world, but also fascinated, but also completely vulnerable and interdependent at the same time. And those are really enriching conversations and ideas and places to be, for kind of hopeful reasons. You know, we can, by looking at a problem differently and creatively, I think you can find practical solutions for these problems, but also help reconcile with the kind of human component of living in these times and trying to, you know, make sense of it.
Do you have some favorites of the, I don't know, artworks, books, writings, whatever, movies, which kind of brought you closer to the topic we are talking here about, or changed your opinion, or something you would recommend, you would like to recommend to us?
So I have many favorite people to think with. I'm from a kind of more theoretical side. I always come back to the work of Donna Haraway, talking about companion species, talking about what we can do with speculative fiction and sci-fi, and how thinking through stories and fiction. I love books. I love reading. I love kind of fantastical adventures, and I love that she brings that into her scholarly work in a very multi-species feminist way. And I always get something new when I read her. And then Anna Singh is an anthropologist who, she has this book, The Mushroom at the End of the World, and she traces the relationship between these Matsuki mushrooms and then big global flows of capital, but always bringing it back to what's going on in these mushroom forests. So from a kind of theoretical standpoint, those are two that I just love. And Anna Singh's been involved with a project called the Feral Atlas, which is just fabulous and fascinating. And it contains all these different stories about our landscapes and the multi-species worlds that are going on there. And she has this quote that contamination is collaboration. You know, we're never purely us. We're always in connection, whether we want to be or not, with others. But then there's also artworks by Rebecca Harris. She's done this amazing piece, Symbiosis, where she's made French knots. She's worked with scientists to map the microbiome, and made French knots of all the different colonies. You can get this idea of the body as a topography, as a landscape that's embellished with the microbial. So instead of thinking about microbes as being something that kind of contaminate or disgust or, you know, scar or mark the body through illness or whatever, they actually become kind of a celebrated part. And there's the whole body is covered apart from the figure is pregnant, so there's no microbes within the uterus and on the fetus. And that really draws our attention to, you know, how do we acquire our microbiome? We either acquire it through when we're born, through the vaginal birth canal, and we become seeded on our skin, and or the environment that we're born in. If we're born in a surgical theater, we get our microbes from the people and environments around us. So that makes me think of kinship and who are we kin with, and how do microbes kind of make up like a a unique imprint of who we are, who our people are, who our whatever our environment is. And I think that's really, really interesting. And going back to AMR, we're thinking about C-sections and how those will become much more dangerous if we can't control infection. And then who does that affect? Then we bring gender into it, and we bring healthcare into it, and access to good healthcare, good hygiene. Sonia Brumel did the oversized Petri dish, which I just love, this kind of gigantic Petri dish where she's lain down in it and grown a whole host of microbes based on what was on her skin. And it's quite a viscerally kind of disgusting image. Like it really makes my skin crawl, but it's fascinating that there's this kind of abject, disgusted reaction, but yet, you know, my skin is covered in microbes, and seeing it in a different way is really fascinating. Sarah Krask has worked with scientists to make, she has this disease map where she's made synpeptides collaborating with scientists based on this medieval panacea called Teriac, and then overlaid that with cholera on this map of Basel in Switzerland. And she's kind of showing how diseases ebb and flow as kind of, you know, an accompaniment to epidemiological works, and a kind of a visual representation. So I get really excited every time I come across someone new working with these themes and kind of grappling with them.
Yeah, that's amazing. And since this last artwork you've mentioned talks about like epidemics, it made me thinking that when did you start your PhD? Pre-COVID, right?
Yes. Yes.
So it was probably kind of impactful on your research. And I wonder, what did change in your way of thinking about the topic you proposed, you know, from the beginning till now?
Mm. Yes, COVID was really interesting. And by interesting, I mean, I kind of just hid from the, well, everyone hid from the world, but I really struggled with my PhD research. I had to kind of grieve the end of, I had my project all mapped out of what I was going to do, and then I had to completely change everything. And that was really difficult to accept, as I, you know, it was for everybody. Everyone kind of had to grieve the future plans that they'd made. And then I kind of was looking at the language that was being used by politicians in newspapers, on social media, and the military metaphor was extremely present. And not only the military metaphor, but in the UK where I live, it's very much along the lines of a kind of blitz spirit, World War II solidarity. And I found that really striking and actually really quite troubling. So I was inspired to write about that, much from my own benefit, to kind of use anthropology and my work to help me process what was going on. And then I started writing about these metaphors and why I think that we should be really careful about using them for COVID.
Actually, it's interesting when you mentioned about the military metaphor regarding COVID, because I always thought that when hearing news about COVID, I felt like those are reporting on the sport games, you know, who is winning, and like, because sport also has a little bit of this narrative of, you know, one against another.
Yeah, I think the sport metaphors trouble me less, especially in you know, scientific circles, talking about sport. There's kind of this idea of there's competition, there's a team working idea there. So this idea that we're on the same team, we've all had to pivot to looking at COVID, or at least the people I'm working with, pivoting to looking at COVID, working together, sharing information, sharing data in ways that actually are really unprecedented. So it's changed the way that scientists are working together, you know, internationally, sharing work. And that, I think, is really, really positive. And then supporting each other like you would support your teammates. But then when we kind of look at the political discourse, this idea of, you know, we all need to sacrifice by doing X, Y, and Z. You know, that we had the clap for the NHS in the UK at the same time that the NHS were not being supplied with adequate personal protective equipment. And it kind of brought the attention away from responsibility on the government and what the government is doing to support frontline and essential workers. Frontline also being a military metaphor that a lot of healthcare workers were saying, you know, we never asked to be frontline soldiers in this war, that, you know, and we want to have access to proper resources, good working conditions, protective equipment, you know, enough staff, enough hospital beds, and, you know, clapping and valorizing their sacrifice is not actually good enough. And then when you look at COVID deaths, 65% of deaths within the NHS were in BAME communities. So that really raises the question of, you know, what kinds of sacrifice are being asked of people, and how is that actually disproportionately affecting people of color? And then again, with the military language, it's very masculine. But then when you look at the actual work that's needed to control the virus and actually live with the virus, a lot of it is traditionally feminine labor. So cleaning, for example, keeping things clean, looking after children because they can't go to school, and homeschooling children. A lot of work inside of the home, organizing the home, typically feminized labor, but under this like masculinized military warfare framing, which then erases that side of things. So COVID, it affected my work, but actually I didn't pivot to want to look at COVID, because I think COVID is a symptom of the problem that I'm trying to look at with AMR, in that we're trying to live with an interconnected planet that is an ecosystem. You know, I think of our bodies as ecosystems within bigger ecosystems. The global flow of people and capital, increasing climate change, increasing vulnerability of populations of humans, but also other kinds of species, making them more vulnerable, increasing zoonotic, the potential for zoonotic encounters for pandemics to spread, and then inequality in terms of healthcare, in terms of, you know, do people have homes that they can self-isolate in? Are people able to take time off work? Can people work from home? There's a lot of inequalities there, and those are political and social and economic questions that we, and problems that we need to be dealing with. So yeah, COVID definitely had a big impact, but it kind of made me more committed to looking at these things within the realm of antimicrobial resistance.
All things you mentioned right now, like they are very much on the systemic level. So for sure, like systems have to change. But I wonder, as individuals, is there anything one can do when dealing with a problem which is so largely impacted by the systems overlapping and being dysfunctional?
It's a really interesting question. I think it's very easy when looking at things that are systemic, that are structural, these really big problems and often quite scary things to kind of think about, all of the implications that can be easily turn into kind of a despair or doom spiral. So on a kind of personal level, I find poetry to be something that really helps me. So the work of like Mary Oliver, for example, who kind of, she's talking about paying attention to the everyday, to our world that is, you know, around us, wherever we actually are, and noticing, you know, who is in our world, like human and non-human. What are we doing? What food are we eating? Where are we walking? Who are we engaging with? And are there kind of small things that we can do to kind of find our community or kind of be more present within our community? So I mean, in terms of, you know, connecting with other people and having relationships that are meaningful and sustaining, including, you know, paying attention to the natural world and looking at, you know, seasons changing, or where is a flower growing in the, you know, on the this crack in the wall? Where is my food coming from? And just kind of increasing the attention that we're paying, one from a kind of mental health, but also a kind of, you know, what am I connected to in the world? And I think that makes a difference. Or even just kind of, if you have the time and you're walking, I walk along the canal a lot where I live, and kind of noticing, there's quite a lot of litter in this canal. And then I started paying more attention, and I noticed there's like a little sign that was like, friends of this canal, we meet once a month. And I'm thinking, okay, something that I can do is I can like pick litter on this canal, maybe, you know, for 1 hour a month. And it's a tiny thing, but I kind of feel like that gives me something to hold on to. It's kind of giving me a bit more agency. I feel like I'm contributing to something that is bigger than me, and that helps. And maybe just by being interested in kind of the microbial world, learning a bit more about, I don't know, I think there's a sense of playfulness that is good to cultivate. And that helps us, I think, maybe be more resilient, but also keep that sense of curiosity and learning. And we can adapt, and just being open to different ways of thinking about the world and who's in it and what's going on.
When you said poetry, I wonder, would it be possible for you, whether now or maybe later, to record maybe some of the like your favorite piece of poetry to illustrate what you've been telling to us? Because I really, when you started to explain that, I was like, I would really like to hear you reading that.
Yeah, I mean, I have been struggling with not necessarily motivation, but just feeling very, very heavy and trying to find ways of still being able to move. And so in the morning, before I get overwhelmed with all the things that I need to do for the day and, you know, sort my life out, one of my favorite things is to kind of sit by the window and just, even if it's for a couple of minutes, just look at something and feel it and think about it. And I'm not a religious person, but I find that that is a kind of spiritual practice that I really need to hold on to. And that's, I don't think it's disconnected from these kinds of ideas that we've been talking about and these problems that we've been talking about. My dad's an engineer, but a building services engineer. So he sorts out all the infrastructure for buildings. And my mom is an artist, craftsperson. And so I think anthropology is kind of the fusing of those two things. It's like looking at the infrastructure that makes a building into a home or into a workspace or whatever. And then the arts is like the soul of it, what transforms that space into something more. And that's what I think anthropology does for my understanding of the world. It's like the infrastructural stuff that makes, you know, the everyday happen. And then you have the, well, what does it mean? Why are we doing it? What could we do it differently? And why bother anyway? What's, you know, so that's my position there.
Wow, I entirely love it, like how we, you know, we started from like very serious scientific kind of a hard science, and then we kind of totally shifted to, you know, very ephemeral, intangible, not measurable kind of a personal dimension. I wish that we could jump from one to another much more frequently, and maybe that's also part of the solution.
Yes, I also feel that my field work was working with scientists and researchers in, there were clinicians, there were microbiologists, so very much engaged in that side of the science. And I feel that the, you know, infrastructural side, the scientific side, the kind of empirical evidence, teleology of progress stuff is much more, it's easier to inhabit that space and get credibility and get your grants funded so you can keep being employed, engage with people as a serious, you know, serious person, serious scholar, whatever. But then this, the driving force of at least what I do and kind of the thing that gives it meaning and enlivens it for me, aside from, I think AMR is a really serious problem and millions of people will suffer and die if we don't find solutions for it. The artistic side, creative side, the spiritual, ephemeral, whatever you want to call it, I think is equally as important, but it doesn't have a space. I feel like that doesn't really have a space in maybe in academia or maybe in the kinds of conversations or language or tools we have to talk about things or engage with things. And I think there's often this misunderstanding that art or poetry is somehow elite or not for the everyday or for, you know, certain kinds of people with certain kinds of sensibilities, when actually it's the opposite. It's giving space to talk about ideas and people, you can be moved by it regardless of, you know, anything that you might have in common, but you can look at this third thing, this artwork, this poem, this film, and feel something or be moved or it sparks something in your mind, or, you know, I think that's really important, but it's not built into how we live our lives, or it's not a priority in the way that other things get prioritized. My next kind of quest is thinking about what are the spaces that we can have these conversations and talk about these things. And promote art, the kind of art and science, anthropology, social sciences in kind of mixed up ways, in accessible ways, and bring the conversation out of kind of academic echo chambers and into kind of maybe more meaningful public spaces. And that's something that I'm thinking about as kind of the next phase of what I'm going to do with this work, with this research.
Wow, I totally see the importance of that tool. And I don't know, like even Ferment Radio is a small kind of attempt to go in that direction. However, I think that, you know, the problem is like a professionalization of things. Like if somebody's professional artist, then you talk to the crowd of the artist. And if somebody's a professional scientist, you talk mainly to the scientists, and it's also the problem with this like a professionalization and the pragmatism itself, right? Like you need to produce results, and I think that again, like it's a problem of a system itself. and the funding, because funding is also very disciplinary. Like, it's very hard to fund things on the kind of, you know, where things start to blur the borders between disciplines.
Absolutely. And it relies on relationships. Like, you need to have a close kind of personal relationship or working relationship with someone in order to make a project happen. And then how do you find those people? And how do you, you know, I was talking to somebody, interviewing someone recently, and they talked about an ecology of research and finding your right research ecology and building a research ecosystem. And I thought that was really interesting for maybe thinking about the future of research and how we work together to kind of solve these big multi-actor, multi-species questions.
I really hope that creating and sustaining these relationships will contribute to a much needed mind shift regarding big multi-species questions such as antimicrobial resistance. It feels that from different and expanded perspectives, a real systemic change is actually possible. Oh, and stick around for 3 more minutes. We have a bonus track today. Iona is sharing with us a few of her favorite poems and quotes, which can help us reflect more on this episode topics. Enjoy.
Science describes accurately from outside. Poetry describes accurately from inside. Science explicates. Poetry implicates. Both celebrate what they describe. We need the languages of both science and poetry to save us from merely stockpiling endless information that fails to inform our ignorance or our irresponsibility. That's a quote from Arts of Living on a Damaged Planet, a piece that Ursula K. Le Guin wrote. And it really speaks to how I see the relationship between poetry, arts, and science. And I would really like to share some of the poems that I have been thinking with and reading recently. So I have, at the moment, on my chair by the window, Mary Oliver poetry books. This one is called, After Reading Lucretius, I Go to the Pond. The slippery green flog. After reading Lucretius, I go to the pond. The slippery green frog that went to his death in the heron's pink throat was my small brother, and the heron with the white plumes, like a crown on his head, who is washing now his great sword beak in the shining pond, is my tall, thin brother. My heart dresses in black and dances. Do stones feel? Do they love their life? Or does their patience drown out everything else? When I walk on the beach, I gather a few. White ones, dark ones, the multiple colors. Don't worry, I say. I'll bring you back. And I do. Is the tree as it rises delighted with its many branches, each one like a poem? Are the clouds glad to unburden their bundles of rain? Most of the world says no. No, it's not possible. I refuse to think to such a conclusion. Too terrible it would be to be wrong. This last one is about finding hope, and it's called Though There Are Torturers by Michael Cody. Though there are torturers in the world, there are also musicians. Though at this moment men are screaming in prisons, there are jazzmen raising storms of sensuous celebration and orchestras releasing glories of the spirit. Though the image of God is everywhere defiled, a man in West Clare is playing the concertina, The Sistine Choir is levitating under the dome of St. Peter's, and a drunk man on the road is singing for no reason.
If you would like to know more about the show, listen to this episode again, or find previous episodes, please go to fermentradio.com. You can subscribe to this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcast, and more. I'm always looking forward to hearing from you at hello@fermentradio.com. Ferment Radio is produced by Super Eclectic and is brought to you by Arts Promotion Center Finland, Culture of Cultures, and the Center of the Social Study of Microbes. This particular episode was recorded during Empowering Tools Residency and Program of the Erasmus Plus Project and Riboka Repository of Knowledge, co-financed by the European Union. The European Commission is not responsible for the content of this publication. Thank you very much for the support, and most of all, thank you all for listening.